Shop the Sherwin-Williams Winter Sale and get 30% off paints and stains January 9th through the 19th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome, or good afternoon, or good morning, wherever you are joining us in the world today. It's a pleasure to see you all again on our show. We have a wonderful, wonderful guest today to introduce you all to, and we have a lot to talk about. It seems that the news is not letting up these days, my dear Sarah. We're going to be in business for a long time, it looks like, or maybe a short time, depending on if three is on the horizon. So first and foremost, tell me, how are you doing? How are you feeling? First, I forgot to say, Merry Christmas to all the Orthodox Christians on the old calendar, all the Orthodox on the Julian calendar. And of course, we have that as well today. But tell me, how are you today? How's everything?
Very dark. I am. Something really broke for me this weekend. I read a really fantastic article by Arnold Bertram, and about how it says Venezuela killed the United States, and it wasn't like a Cope article about, you know, Venezuela actually won. No, it was like, you lost your morality. And once that's gone, and I saw that too, even before I read the article, and every day just keeps getting darker. Today is another very, very dark day, domestically and internationally.
It certainly feels that way. And of course, you know, we have the darkness. We also have the light. So let's see if we can bring some clarity to this all with our next guest. So
First, we need to preview your, don't be shy, you're being humble. Chris's interviews with the Ukrainian prisoners of war. We have a sneak peek. These are being published today and over the next couple days. So check this out, and then we will bring up Glenn.
Like the majority of people, I lived, I worked. So it was work, home, friends. So in 2023, it was 4th of May, I was going to work.
Ехал на работу, и товарищи с ТЦК меня погрузили, так
скажем. TRC busified
на тот момент еще, да, не в бусик,
but
конечно,
но... It wasn't busification, they didn't джип. Put me in the bus,
отвезли
but they put
военкомат,
me in a jeep.
На 6 мая выписали боевую повестку.
Recruitment office, they gave me the summons.
Но на тот момент еще было, давали возможность поехать домой, собрать вещи.
They still gave possibility to go back home to pack.
Ну и до 24 года, до 26 августа
so
я собирал эти вещи.
August 2024, I was packing.
Ну и 26 августа я уже возвращался с работы, стояла машина скорой помощи.
To work, and I was stopped by the
мимо проходил, а в ней оказалось 5 сотрудников ТЦК уже вместе с полицией.
It was the car filled with officers of TRC together with police.
Проверили документы, розыск, наручники, медкомиссия за 15 минут,
hands,
и через 2 часа я еду уже в учебную часть.
And, I ended up in the training center.
So that video, as well as Glenn's YouTube, are both linked in the replies. Welcome so much, Glenn, and thank you for coming. Glenn, as you guys probably already know, is a Norwegian political scientist and professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, specializing in Russian foreign policy, geoeconomics, and the rise of Greater Eurasia. My favorite book of his is The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order. It was published in 2023, but it's still very, very relevant. So if you guys have not read that, I highly recommend it. It's pinned on his profile. Glenn, welcome to the show finally. Chris, take it away.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And of course, for those who don't know, Professor Glenn has also been a frequent guest here as well, and also asked questions of President Putin and many others at Valdai, many other places. We've seen him and also been around many of the international institutions and really bringing some clarity to many of the issues in the world today. Of course, the most glaring one, the elephant in the room, so to speak, is what has transpired over the past few days in Venezuela. We've had shocking images coming out of Venezuela in the early morning hours. Words can't even describe necessarily that morning here in Russia when I got word from my Venezuelan comrades that there was bombing in Caracas and things were happening. So I want to ask you, Professor, what do you make of all this? What are your thoughts on it? And what's going on with the United States kidnapping a president of a sovereign country, dragging him and his wife, who clearly has been beaten by these Delta Force guys, these brutes, and bringing them to the U.S. to stand trial in a federal court in New York?
Well, first, let me thank you for the kind introduction and the invitation. I think everyone was shocked by what happened in Venezuela. I think the brazenness of the whole thing is what really stood out. I mean, this is not the first war either against a Latin American country or anywhere in the world. Indeed, they're becoming much more frequent. But usually, the political West has a tendency to dress up their wars as liberal democratic wars. So we put the international law aside because we have to take into consideration democracy or human rights. This is how wars are sold. That is, Trump, he seemed to have dropped that whole pretense, and he essentially announced that they took our oil, we want it back, whatever that might mean. They attacked, as you said, killed a lot of people, kidnapped the president and his wife, and then shipped them off to a court in New York to give the whole thing some resemblance of a legality. But it's a bit shocking. And the Europeans, of course, they want to give their backing to Trump so he will, you know, perhaps reward them for their loyalties. But instead, the very next day, he essentially declares, well, next I want Greenland. And they thought that they would be spared because of their obedience. But I think increasingly their obedience is being seen as a weakness by Trump. And it's been taken advantage of. So, no, the whole thing is quite chaotic. And in terms of the U.S., the U.S. objectives, I think it's... Trump, he tweets it or sends it on Truth Social. So it's quite obvious what it is. I mean, when he posts, this is our hemisphere, he calls it the Monroe Doctrine, but that's a bit of a perversion. In reality, he recognizes that the world is becoming multipolar. You have other centers of power like China. The U.S. can't compete as it did in the past. So the solution then is he can't rely on the free market then. You use military force to establish an exclusive zone of influence. And that's more or less what he wants, I think, that convert Venezuela into an exclusive American gas station.
It feels a little bit like we're in a time machine, like we're going back to the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries in terms of the games of big empires and the military exploits that they had in different parts. I mean, the United States is not new to this, as we know. They militarily conquered Cuba, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, the Philippines. There were many other big exploits in Latin America, especially in the 19th to the 20th century. So it just seems that all of this, you know, sort of Fukuyama, you know, after 1990s, early 1990s, that somehow this liberal international, this rules-based international order was somehow here to stay is out the window. I guess now even... people are talking once again about this great power competition again and dividing the world into zones of and spheres of influence. What do you make of this as someone who studies geoeconomics, geopolitics, and more importantly, the history and development of these great powers and their forces?
Well, at the end of the Cold War, you had two key theses. One was that of Fukuyama, which suggested the world would now be in perpetual peace. It would organize under liberal democracy and American leadership, and this would then allow us to transcend the international anarchy. And essentially, it would be the end of history. The other was Samuel Huntington, who essentially said, well, that's not how human beings work. We will organize in groups and we will compete for security and all of this. And he foresaw that... just because an ideological struggle was over, it wouldn't. Most likely, the next competition would be more civilizational, which seemed more credible than the Fukuyama's. But it has to be said though that this liberal, open international economic system, it's often premised on conditions. That is, the hegemonic power. When there's a lot of concentration in the hegemon, it feels confident. It has the incentive to have an open system. That is freedom of navigation, because it is the leading economic power. It wants free trade, because if it's the dominant industrial and technological power, it means it can saturate markets. And of course, if there's an open economic system, its banks and currencies will be used around the world. So there's an incentive. What we are always known, which maybe Fukuyama didn't read, is when that hegemon is in decline, it's more likely to then return to more neo-mercantilist traditions. That is, deny the access to technologies, deny access to banks, currencies, and of course, and the freedom of navigation as well. And this is a key component. I think many people forget that when the United States became an empire after defeating the Spanish in 1898, and of course got all these colonial possessions, a lot of the strategies were built up around the ideas of an American naval officer, Alfred Tyrman, who his ideas essentially was very central in creating the U.S. an empire, and the ideas were, yeah, well, quite simple. That is, to control of the seas are decisive for the foundation of a great power status. So if the U.S. would want to replace the United Kingdom, it would have to control the seas. And of course, when you're hegemon, you can facilitate the freedom of navigation. But when you're in decline, then you use that naval power to prohibit your rivals from being able to trade, move troops, and this becomes your source of dominance. So a lot of the things that are happening now should have been very predictable. I at least been writing about it for the past 10 years that this was going to come. But again, I think we've been consumed by ideology that, as Fukuyama suggested, we just transcended history.
I think on that note, speaking of the seas, we have this, forget about Pirates of the Caribbean, we have Pirates of the North Atlantic. We have this Trump administration, which is ramping up pressure on various vessels that are involved in the logistics and trade and import-export of, for example, crude oil. And to enforce these sanctions, they're basically taking over so-called Iranian or Russian oil tankers that are so-called busting the sanctions and running the blockade, so to speak. I want to ask you, I mean, we just had today a Russian-flagged cruiser that was taken over. I want to ask, what do you make of this? What do you make of this piracy on the high seas, a violation of international law, as the Russian foreign ministry said, and the fact that this power dynamic is clearly reshaping not only the land-based orders of, but also the sea-based order and what's going on in the high seas? Pretty soon we're going to have vessels basically shadowed by military ships to make sure that they're transported safely. What do you make of this?
No, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. Of course, this is illegal. It's a criminal behavior, but it builds on the key objective, which is not just for the U.S. to steal Venezuela's oil. It's not that important that it's only sold to the U.S. or that it's sold to the U.S., but it's that only sold to the United States. That is to cut off other trading partners. So they should not be allowed to trade with China and Russia and others. This is the basic idea. Now, again, it's not as if control of the seas and seeing this as a tool to go after adversaries is something new. By the way, I can add that it's not just in the along the coast of Venezuela and in the North Atlantic. They've also been going after Russian ships in the Black Sea, even in the Mediterranean, pretending that these are Ukrainians, but no one seriously thinks that the Ukrainians attacked the Russian ships in the Mediterranean or on the coast of Africa. So these are European and likely American intelligence agencies either working with the Ukrainians or just doing it themselves and pretending it's the Ukrainians. So this is the new reality. The freedom of navigation is more or less it's not over, but it's being reduced. But it's always been like this. When you look at how they attempted to to contain China after World War II, they have these two island chains off the coast. This is to set up important choke points. If they have a conflict with China, the goal would then be to shut down the Strait of Malacca, South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait. And this is how military strategy works. And they will start to attack perhaps Chinese ships. Same with Russia. It has three oceans on its western borders. It's the Black Sea. This is why we're in Ukraine. We're trying to expel the Russians from the Black Sea. We have the Baltic Sea, which after expanding NATO, especially getting Finland and Sweden, we even had a former NATO Secretary General say that now we can put a blockade on St. Petersburg. We can put, we can even conquer Kaliningrad. We can make the Baltic Sea a NATO lake. And of course, the Arctic, where Scandinavia is now being built up as a front line. So going after sea lanes is nothing new. It's just when the hegemon is confident, it wants to build trust. Not just its technologies and banks and currency, but also in transportation corridors. That hegemon is gone. So now it's going to weaponize the former control it had to try to weaken adversaries and strengthen itself. So, but again, yes, piracy is a good word because that's exactly what it is.
You mentioned China. I do have a clip of China's reaction to the seizure of the ship. I want to play and then get the reactions, the thoughts from both of you.
The United States has brazenly resorted to the use of force against Venezuela and demanded that America First be applied when Venezuela disposes of its own oil resources. This is a typical act of bullying, a serious violation of international law, and a grave infringement on Venezuela's sovereignty that also severely undermines the rights of Venezuelan people. China strongly condemns this. I would like to stress that the legitimate rights and interests of China and other countries in Venezuela must be protected. The United States has long imposed illegal unilateral sanctions on Venezuela's oil sector and has recently brazenly used force against Venezuela, dealing a severe blow to the country's economic and social order, and also threatening the stability of global production and supply chains. China has already issued strong condemnation in this regard. I would like to reiterate that cooperation between China and Venezuela is a cooperation between sovereign states and is protected by international law and laws of both countries.
Of all appearances, this just looks like a strongly worded statement. But from all the news that I'm getting, the Chinese fleet is still sailing for Venezuela. What do you guys think China should do or will do in this situation? I think people are getting a little nervous at China's inaction. So I want your thoughts.
Sorry. If you ask me, I think... it's very problematic for China because they do trade with heavily with Venezuela. They buy their oil, so this is important. But it's not just Venezuela. The United States has signaled very clearly that this is wider, the so-called Donro Doctrine, in which they want to subjugate all of Latin America. They already said that next in line could be Cuba, it could be Nicaragua, it could be Mexico. You know, they could go for Panama. Colombia should watch its back. I mean, they're all threatened now. So this is problematic because I think China is, more or less the main trading partner to most of these countries. So the U.S. has made it clear they want to reverse this and they're willing to use military force to do so. So again, this has a lot of instability written all over it. It's also a foolish thing, you can add, because one of the big achievements over the past decades is the ability to promote the idea that international law should dictate international commerce instead of brute force, as you just suggested, as you don't need warships to make sure that your cargo gets where it has to go. But a lot of countries, such as China, they're following this. They realize they can prosper, become wealthy if they follow this system. And indeed, the United States had a key role in advancing this. And now it's just all being torn down. And I don't think they realize what they're actually doing here, because you can't, once this has been torn down, it's very hard to rebuild this kind of trust.
I agree. And I think that one of the big issues now is in reshaping the world and basically trying to renegotiate a lot of these rules and a lot of the, I would say, the norms at how international trade and commerce is done. Eventually, it's going to embolden certain sectors of various, various political forces within each country to be more hardline. I mean, one of the discussions today in Moscow has been, how do we react to this? You know, how do we address this? We're in the midst of so-called peace peace negotiations. We're trying to backchannel with the Americans, and the Americans are rubbing it in the face of the Russians and trying to see if they can get a reaction or if the Russians are going to push back. And I think that, you know, I feel, my personal opinion, is that we are back in a scenario where each country is faced with its hardliners and its more reformists, or kind of, you know, I would say the people who want a more open and liberal kind of view of the world. And I think that the hardliners now are going to win the day, because they're going to say, look, if the other country is doing this by brute power and basically challenging our rights, our ability to trade freely, our ability to ensure that our commerce can proceed as usual. Not only our commerce, even our military fleets can navigate international waters as is protected in the law of the seas. Then I think what we're going to see is similar in the Cold War and even before in the age of imperialism, which is merchant ships with military vessels. And in the modern world today, you're going to have even people, we're talking about it here, oil tankers with submarines next to them, basically to protect them. It feels like something out of World War I or World War II. But this is what I feel like we're getting back into here. So China, of course, I don't think wants to see this escalate. Neither does Russia. But the question is, if this is going to force their hand to have to then respond, not necessarily with force, but to protect their interests by allowing their militaries also to navigate the seas and to protect their commercial interests.
Yeah, well, also, they have to ask whether or not they should start to do the same, that is to seize or sink the ships of rivals. Now, you can say, well, that sounds very irresponsible, but you can turn it the other way around, saying not doing so is extremely irresponsible, because what is international law? There is no international court anywhere who determines everything. There's no world government, essentially. So international law is a set of rules which implies the assumption of a reciprocity, that is, all sides accept that they will restrain themselves in certain ways in terms of how they act in the international system, with the assumption that the other side will do the same. Now, the problem is when you end up one side breaking the rule. Let's say that the NATO countries think, well, this is the new rule. We can seize the ships of other countries if we, you know, put our own unilateral sanctions, and we can even sink ships through proxies. But they can't do it to us. Well, now international law is breaking down. So you can argue the only way you can get international law back is if you start to sink the ships of other countries as well, do the same. Then the NATO countries essentially would have an incentive to sit down and restore international law, come up with an agreement. Okay, we don't hijack each other's ships. Let's not go into piracy and basic things. But unless it's backed up by the possibility of force, we often see that international law weakens. This is part of the problem, by the way, in the post-Cold War era. International law, in accordance to the UN Charter, established after the World War II, that is, because there was a balance of power, there was a desire for reciprocity. In a unipolar world, why would the hegemon accept restraint on itself? It doesn't make any sense. So this is why in the post-Cold War era, you have all these new ideas like democracy promotion, humanitarian interventionism, the global war on terror, all of this as one common thing, that is sovereignty for me, but not for you, because one side is able to maintain its sovereignty, but it becomes limited for the other side. So I think, again, I'm not advocating for Russia to sink NATO ships, just to make it clear for whoever's listening. I'm just saying this is usually how international law would work and sustain itself. It has to be based on reciprocity.
Well, I also fear that people are getting quite emboldened. Now that we have the abduction of Maduro, in hindsight, we look back on the attempt on Putin's life recently, the drone attack. At first, Trump said he didn't even know what happened. Then he said Russia was lying. Now information is coming out suggesting the USA at least knew it was happening, if not allowed it or ordered it to happen. What do you make of this? Like, Russia needs to react to this.
No, I agree. But this has kind of been the dilemma for the Russians over the years now as well. That is, what does it do when the Western countries escalate? Because if it retaliates, then of course it can result in a direct war. And given that we're nuclear powers, we're talking possible nuclear exchange. On the other hand, if Russia does nothing, well, you can read the Western newspapers, what they say. Aha, we can step over all the red lines. They won't do anything. They're too afraid. They're deterred. They're a paper tiger, you know, blah, blah, blah. We all seen these headlines. So, but the problem is with every escalation, it gets worse and worse. And we, if you remember in the beginning, they said, oh, well, we can't send more than helmets, or we can't send tanks, or we can't send HIMARS, or F-16s, Biden said. This would mean World War III. Well, not anymore. Now you have British, Americans, essentially launching long-range missiles into Russian territory, which are managed by American contractors. They're American missiles. They're targeting based on American intelligence agencies. And what to strike is also decided by American war planners. So this is a direct war now. It's not it's crossed the line of a proxy war a long time ago. But my point is, we've seen some of this before in terms of targeting of Putin's house. If you remember the strike on Russia's nuclear deterrent with all these drones which are smuggled in, and then soon thereafter, you see an almost identical attack within Iran. So, you know, I think the Russians know that despite Trump's efforts to portray himself as a mediator, this is very much still an American war. The CIA still is deeply engaged. So, so the idea that now Trump is our friend because he wants to end the war, no, he's... Trump doesn't. He wants. If he wants to end the war, at least a shooting war, it's because it's not in America's interest. He's not doing any favors. It's in his interest, you know, to weaken Russia. It's in his weakness to have to extract some wealth from the Europeans. There's a lot of interest at play, but I think the Russians aren't blind. They know what Trump is all about, but. Again, I think there's still an interest in Moscow to play along.
I think on that note, there's also today the news that Zelensky, referencing Maduro's kidnapping, also called for the United States to do something similar to Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov and to basically go after and kidnap, you know, of course, basically what's seen as the number two strongman in Russia, the leader of the Republic of Chechnya. And I think that this is also seen as a brazen escalation. Of course, Kadyrov absolutely destroyed Zelensky in his post.
He invited him. He's a cub. He's a
tremendous cub. We're waiting for you, you know? So I want to. How do you see this kidnapping? I mean, we've had in the past, we had the invasion and basically capturing of Noriega. We had the basic capturing of Milosevic. This is not new, but this kind of brazen kidnapping of a sovereign leader in the middle of the night without any sort of major escalation or anything like that, is this a new normal, you think?
It could be. Again, the whole thing was just bizarre. Why did it take his wife? And the optics are so horrible. You kidnap the wife of a president, and then she shows up the next day she shows up later in court in New York with bruises all over her face. I mean, this is just it's poor optics. Let's leave it at that. But I think it could be the new normal, and I think this is a big problem because I don't think the West is able to adjust to a post-hegemonic order because. For the past 500 years, the West has been leading ever since the age of exploration. And suddenly we have to find our position as non-hegemonic. I think it's going to be a very difficult transition as you see the relative decline. And it's decline in many areas. It's the economic. You see the decline in the politics, that is the trust in politicians, the institutions. Overall, cultural decline, you can point to many things, but one of the costs of this is, of course, that the rule of law also collapses. And it's not just, you know, in terms of strategic in order to fight off the Venezuelans or Russians and Chinese. You see it internally as well. The rule of law is weakened very fast. If you look at Europe now, for example, the EU can just sanction its own citizens. There's no legal recourse. There's no nothing you can do. There's no day in court. They just, if you, you know, you might have done something wrong, they say, oh, you've been promoting pro-Russian talking points. Well, no one identifies exactly what that means. And you will suddenly find out that you can't travel. You can't buy food. That your bank accounts are frozen. You can't escape. And you know, there's nothing you can do. You can't go to court. There's nothing. This is just how things have become. So, you know, we can steal the sovereign funds of other countries. It's just, it's becoming lawless. And so everything is falling apart very, very quickly.
I agree. And I guess I think what everybody wants us to ask about is, you're from Norway, but Denmark, same thing. The Greenland drama. Like, what is going on? I have a very legitimate fear that Trump comes in through the back door, steals Greenland, and that kind of sort of creates a collapse of NATO. Maybe that's wishful thinking. But what do you think about this ploy to grab Greenland? I think Mark Rutte today said that they could put as many troops as they want on Greenland. Marco Rubio said they're going to have meetings about it. They want to buy it. Where do you see this kind of going?
I think the U.S. has many different possibilities. They can threaten to invade, and they can invade, of course. But it can also be, if the Danes think they're going to lose it anyways, that they might as well make some money. So, you know, either we take it by force or you sell it. Alternatively, they have a fairly small population of in Greenland, so it would be easier to take it if you first decouple it from Denmark, and that could be done by, you know, staging a democratic revolution, revolution of dignity. They have done this before, and decouple it from Denmark, and then of course there would be a big step closer. So there's many things they could do, but I saw an interview with Stephen Miller, and he was asked by the journalist, well, would you use military force to take it? It's like, well, what do you mean military force? Because they can just sail in and plant a flag, because his point was they're not going to fight us. And that's true. The Europeans aren't going to fight the United States. We have nothing to bring to the fight. We don't have much weapons. The little weapons we had, we gave to Ukraine. And that's the big irony of Denmark, by the way. They gave almost all of their key, a lot of their key weaponry. I forgot which, if it was their artillery shells or something. They gave absolutely everything. So they've been one of the most hawkish countries. I mean, their prime minister makes Kaja Kallas seem sane. So she's very, very hawkish. But it's also, I'm not going to say karma, but let's go with karma. If you look at the role of Denmark they had, in the post-Cold War era, they very much aligned up with this hegemonic order. When it was time to go after Yugoslavia, they were happy to dismantle it. They pride themselves of being among the first to recognize Kosovo. This is something they did. They joined in on the coalition of the willing to invade Iraq in 2003. I mean, they went along with the United States on all of this hegemonic missions and didn't really care much about international law in any of the instances. So now, of course, the world is changing. That is, the world is multipolar, which means that the United States have other priorities around the world. Europe is not one of them, and not one of the top two, at least. And the U.S. see more interest in controlling these territories themselves instead of relying on an increasingly weaker and less relevant Europe. So now essentially they're on the other side of this equation. Now they're the one who might be stripped of territory. And we see the U.S. national security strategy say, well, these European countries, they run hopelessly. There's a risk of their civilization going under. We will help them. I forgot the wording. It was something along the line, we will cultivate the opposition. So now they might regime change Europe. This is where we are. But the Europeans haven't really figured out yet, because We still think that we are the objects. We're the one, so the subjects. We're the ones sitting at the table moving the piece around the chessboard with the Americans. We don't have a seat there anymore. We are the pieces on the board. And this is very difficult for the Europeans to accept after all these centuries.
That's quite a scary, that's kind of where I was at too. I was like, well, they think that they're even still at the table, but they definitely aren't. And hypothetically, if Trump were to come in and take Greenland, their choices really are pretty grim. And I think that the best choice is to do nothing and just cede the land. I think if they went against him, that would break up NATO, or Trump is so volatile. He might just say, forget it. We won't even protect you if Russia comes knocking at your door, which could then send Europe into the throes of paranoia or preeminent strike. Like, it just could get so out of hand. It's very scary.
Yeah, but this is the foolish part of the EU, because by making Russia into an enemy, and this was always very unnecessary, and it has to be added, the reason why Russia was made into enemy is because they wanted to anchor the US in Europe after the Cold War, because the US is a pacifier, and also it has proper power, so it's a good country to align with. But the price of this was to make Russia into an enemy. Keep in mind that in the beginning of the 90s, we had all these agreements with Russia for a pan-European security architecture, such as the Charter of Paris for New Europe. However, the Americans instead pushed NATO expansion. This canceled all our common European security architecture and again, revived the Cold War logic and redivided the continent. This is why in 2008, the Europeans pushed back when the Bush administration wanted Ukraine to join NATO. We knew, as Angela Merkel said, that this would be interpreted as a declaration of war by Moscow. So they knew this would happen, but that was the price they were willing to pay to keep the US on the continent. Now, the irony now is that the world is becoming multipolar, and not just Trump. There was initially Obama that said we have to pivot to Asia. But anyways, now that the world is multipolar and the Russians are fighting back, we made ourselves excessively dependent on the US, and the US knew how to take advantage. They say, oh, don't trade with Russia, don't trade with China, put some sanctions on Iran, that as well, even though they broke out of the nuclear agreement, put some tariffs on and sanctions on the Indians. So suddenly the EU has no partners left in the world except for the US, and put all their eggs in that basket. Now the US can dictate everything, and as long as the war goes on, the Europeans will be reliant on the US as a security provider. This is why Donald Trump can go golfing on his golf course in Scotland and tell the head of the EU to show up and sign whatever trade agreements he puts in front of her. This is the problem of excessive dependence. But the Europeans did this to themselves. They're the one who decided that we should make an enemy out of Russia, that this is a price we're willing to pay to have the US on the continent. Now the US is leaving the continent, and we're facing a very angry and strong Russia. And I think the Europeans have messed it up very badly for themselves.
Go ahead, Chris, you go.
I was going to ask you, because you mentioned now Iran, I got to ask you about Iran. We are on the precipice of the possibility of another war of aggression by the Zionists, by Israel, and by the United States on Iran. We're seeing domestically, internally in Iran, and I'm Iranian, I'm talking to family there, and they are deeply concerned, not necessarily about the internal stuff. Internal stuff always, people are upset about the economic situation, but some of this looks like regime change type propaganda from outside to try to portray that Iran is somehow, falling apart, that Ayatollah Khamenei is going to go to Moscow. All of it, nobody believes it in Iran. But the main thing is they're not concerned necessarily about internal stuff. They're concerned about another war of aggression. What do you make of the threats, the escalations, and really what does Tel Aviv and Washington's alignment look like on the possibility of opening up military action again on Iran?
Well, the first war didn't go as the Israelis and the US had hoped, because the Iranians started delivering too many painful blows to Israel, and then they called off the war. But again, this doesn't mean they want peace with Iran. It just means you regroup, rebuild, and then you have another go. And I think it's very predictable that this will happen. You see it in the rhetoric that we can't accept Iran having these ballistic missiles, this and that. And of course, these efforts to destabilize the economy, and suddenly even Trump becomes the humanitarian, in which he warns Iran, you know, if you kill any protesters, then we will come and help them. We're locked and loaded and ready to go, he tweeted. So this is kind of the, you know, the intentions are clear. The capabilities are also being shipped to the region. So I kind of take it as granted now that they will go after Iran. I actually was in Tehran in May, right before the war, and they, you know, they knew this was likely to escalate and come as well. And I think this time they see it as well. This is it's gonna come. And if you hear it from the Israeli leadership as well, we have a historic opportunity now. We have weakened Hamas. We weakened Hezbollah. We weakened the Houthis. And, you know, there might be some protests within Iran. We can, if we bomb a little bit, the people will overthrow the government. I mean, it's, they're building up the rhetoric towards the war. So, I think that's going to happen. But I think then you will have a larger involvement by Russia and China, because this is not Venezuela. They don't want to, you know, be too aggressive in on America's own borders, in its own backyard. But if you start to try to knock out Iran, that's something neither Russia or China can afford. And then also you're in their backyard. So then I think then they will face much greater resistance. And from what I understand, there's already been the Chinese and Russians have already been helping Iran to rebuild its air defenses and drone capabilities. Although the Iranians seem to be quite good in that area themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the impending something on Iran and with the recent recognition of Somaliland, it looks like Israel is just going to sort of terraform their own sphere of influence. After the recognition of Somaliland, I believe the new leader said that he would be joining the Abraham Accords, and Bibi mentioned that he would like to expand them way out into Central Asia even further. I'm guessing maybe after this impending attack on Iran, Bibi has his office has announced he'll be visiting South America to talk about and celebrate the Isaac Accords. You have Professor Zhang on frequently. You're so lucky. We have covered his lectures in depth on Twitter and in spaces. And he didn't coin, but helped popularize the term Pax Judaica. With these accords happening and all of the sort of moves the United States has made and your conversations with Professor Zhang, what do you think? It's a lot, I know. I'm sorry.
No, it's very interesting. He's not looking into a crystal ball. He's looking at the former historical presidents. Yes. He's looking at the, you know, game theory to play it out. And some very convincing arguments in terms of, what are likely developments. So, I'm not sure about the Pax Judaica, though, but there's some strong arguments there. I think overall the expectations or assumption, or almost taking for granted that there has to be another war with Iran. I think to some extent Israel becomes almost like a bubble. If they always push outwards, and if they ever stop growing, then the whole thing might start to fall apart, because they already overstretched themselves. And I'm not sure, but it's I definitely agree that this war is coming.
Yeah, it's that kind of that idea. It's one of the sort of tenets of fascism, that you have to continuously stay kinetic, and if you kind of stop growing, you kind of die. Do you see that in the Israelis as well, with this sort of Abraham and Isaac Accords, at least in a soft way?
No, definitely. And the problems for the Israelis as well is that they keep all of this expansion, it tears away in many ways. It's the material, because they're militarily overstretched. It's the human factor becoming exhausted. And at a deeper level, many people begin to question the whole ethos of of the country because, what were we supposed to be all about? Just set up camp in the Middle East and destroy all our neighbors. It's harmful for any society to be in perpetual war, and Israel is in perpetual war, so it's not good for them for them either. So this was a war concern also in the United States when they were expanding from the east westwards. It was the whole Frederick Turner, I forgot his name. Anyways, the whole thesis that once the U.S. couldn't expand anymore, then it would start to focus on its internal problems instead, and then crisis would set in. However, the situation got rescued because once they reached the Pacific, they launched an empire instead, and then through the Pacific, so that was taken care of. But that's a convincing theory, though, the one you referred to.
Let me ask you, so we're in 2026, we're early, we like doing our little conspiracy minute, but I want to ask you in the crystal ball moment, I want to ask you, it's early in the year, what do you predict for 2026? What are we going to see? We had a lot of very interesting perspectives given, but what are you paying attention to for this year? And what can we most likely expect this coming year?
Well, I think the Ukraine war, it will... it can't continue in its current state because the Ukrainian army is largely exhausted. So, but again, I don't have how the different actors will respond. I don't know. It could be that the NATO countries seek to escalate and get more directly involved in this war, or they just try to slow down the Russians by being more aggressive in terms of attacking their ships, attacking deep into Russia, in which the Russians would be compelled to respond. But the way the war has been going for the past 4 years, I think this is coming to an end. You see it in the manpower, the equipment, the morale, political stability, the economics. Nothing seems to work. I think you also expect to see some crisis within the EU, even NATO. But again, it's harder to time it only for 2026, but obviously things are going south. like all predictions, I think it's difficult because there's too many variables at play. One of the main things I think will come in 2026 is an economic crisis because, you can see that it's already building up. If you're into buying gold and silver, you just see what's happened over the past few months. I think there's an economic crisis coming our way, and that's going to change a lot of the calculation. But beyond all of these things, the one reason I like to talk to Professor Zhang is the focus on US-China, because these are really the two main pieces now in terms of economic power. So the extent to which they're able to find a new acceptable status quo, or they will either intensify the economic war or escalate it into something militarily, I think that's an important thing to watch.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you. I know we both want to thank you so much for coming on the show. We look forward to having you again soon, and also hope to see you out here sometime. Next time you're in this part of the world, please let us know. Let me know for sure. And love to see you and connect again. And we'll stay tuned to all of your great work. Please, everyone, follow Professor Glenn's work. Where can our viewers find your work? We'll link it below, too.
Oh, yeah. I'm on Twitter. I have a YouTube page, obviously, with my podcast and a Substack. I know that you are very big on Telegram. I actually have a Telegram channel, but I have like 3,000 subscribers. I have several fake accounts in my name, which are doing so much better. They have like 60,000-70,000 and all. And so fake Glenn does much better than real Glenn, apparently. But mainly Twitter, YouTube and Substack.
Any books on the horizon?
I'm trying to finish one now, but I've been a bit swamped with other things. But I'm writing a book on the crisis of liberalism. And
you could be writing that for the rest of your life.
I know. But it's a good time to finish it because I was supposed to have finished it during the summer already, and it would have been nice to have it now because When you see the trust in the freedom of navigation, all these things falling apart, the sanctioning of your own citizens, this kind of stuff, it would have been good to have the book out already, because it was predictable to some extent that this is the direction we're headed.
But, thank you so much, Glenn, and I look forward to having you on again.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much, Professor.
So I guess people want us to talk about this ICE shooting, but guys, I'm going to start by saying what it sounds like, there will not be very much investigation. But the reason why I'm bringing it up is because the incident has already been labeled the woman who passed away. Okay, let me start from the beginning with what happened, what transpired, or what the facts currently say. Woman, a U.S. citizen, female, was somehow in an area where police were trying to conduct an operation. She was ordered to stop her vehicle. Instead of stopping, she reversed and then started driving away. The officer shot into her driver's side window, hit her in the face. She was DOA. She was deceased, and she accelerated, and her car got into an accident. There's various angles you guys can go look at this from. I'm not going to argue with people about whether he was right to shoot her or not, because the whole thing is horrific. Everything around it is horrific. ICE operations are horrific. Her being shot in the face is horrific. It's all horrific. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because we covered this on our show literally a month ago to the day. We covered the Pam Bondi memo. Everybody can get labeled a domestic terrorist now. And so if you're killed by ICE, they're not federal agents. They're not federalized, or they're not police officers, I should say. They're not lawful officers. But in this scenario, when you're a domestic terrorist and you are obstructing ICE operations, there won't be any recourse for your death. So just be mindful about how you act and what you say, because if you are labeled a domestic terrorist, all bets are off. And that includes anybody who is anti-capitalist, anti-American, anti-Zionist. So just keep that in mind. The entire scene is so horrific. I won't argue either way, because I just don't believe that people deserve to die at all. And now Blackhawks, this is so ironic and almost, I can't even laugh because it's not even cool or funny anymore. There's Blackhawks now descending upon Minneapolis. That's where Somalis live. Like, did we literally bring the war home? We brought the war home. Blackhawks over the majority Somali area. Does it get more repetitious than that? Does it? Gustavo Petro said, politics is a boomerang. I mean, we could just pull up all the sayings. Foreign policy becomes domestic policy. This is literally bringing the war home. We've crossed a lot of lines this week, in the last week or so.
We have. So those videos, first and foremost, my condolences and sympathies to the family and friends of the woman who's now deceased, killed by ICE agent. The woman was acting in a legal observer capacity. I'm a longtime legal observer. I was a member of the National Lawyers Guild for many years, very proud member of the legal observing team in Vermont and New Hampshire. Did a lot of legal observing, especially during the protests for Palestine in defense of the Palestinians against the genocide, the various campuses that were basically home to a lot of student activism, and a lot of the encampments that went up at the University of Vermont, at Dartmouth College, and many others. I take my job very seriously, and this woman, from what we know, was in a legal observing capacity. Legal observers are to be protected by law enforcement. That's why we have special hats that identify us. And clearly, she felt that the situation from the video looked to be dangerous, and she tried to leave. At this point, there's no indication from what I've seen that she was in any way doing anything criminal. So
no, she wasn't.
From my legal background, it looks like cold-blooded murder to me. And it's very shocking. Actually, you know, I had family members reach out and say, thank God you're not here, because I always volunteered for some of the most difficult legal observing operations. And I would always put myself in harm's way and try to make sure that citizens have their constitutional rights protected. But at this point, I could have just been labeled a domestic terrorist and get a bullet to my head. And who's going to say anything, who's going to do anything? So I just want to say that the United States is getting to be a very scary place. I'm very worried. And this is an ideological issue. I have a lot of friends on the right wing who agree with me, and we talk all the time. And they're deeply concerned about our constitutional rights. Everybody across the spectrum should be protecting our rights to speech, our rights to assembly, our rights to a free press. All of these things are critical. At the very least, because if you silence one side, the boomerang comes for the other side. So if I were to advocate, for example, that people who participated in January 6th should be silenced, well, now all the Palestinian voices are silenced. All of the anti-imperialist voices are silenced. Trump saying he should crack down on all the Code Pink activists who are talking about Venezuela. He's going after politicians who are critical of U.S. foreign policy, including Representatives Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene. So I just want to say, people need to be standing up to defend their basic rights. I'm not asking you to take an ideological position one way or another. I'm asking you to defend basic rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, that are agreed upon throughout the United States, and things that we've defended on all sides of the aisle since they were enshrined in that document. So I just think that it's a very grim time for the United States. Those of you who are legal observing, just be careful.
Take care. I wasn't going to show the video, but I want you to think about think about earlier this week. They said if Iran even harms a protester, they're going in. Imagine if this video was from Iran, Russia, or China, or Venezuela. The woman was deceased. The car and the ICE agents continue to work. They went on to the next operation. No pause.
We're not even going to show the video of the aftermath, but they just walked nonchalantly. Like, mm-hmm. we just gunned down. You know what my first thought was? Because it's Christmas here, and I'm thinking in a, you know, as my theological self, and I'm thinking, do these people have no humanity?
None.
This is a woman who's shot. The guy just runs and says, "Oh, call 911."
Yeah. A doctor came onto the scene. They blocked him from rendering medical aid. They blocked the ambulance from getting to her vehicle, and they dragged her lifeless body to the ambulance and threw her in it. That's how we treat human life. This is the reaction. This is why Black Hawks are flying in now.
Okay, it looks like they are throwing snowballs as the officers are leaving. So again, I believe it was a state patrol, and we did see some MPD officers who were leaving that scene. Mm-hmm. Hennepin County telling us that their sheriff's deputies have not been on that scene, but it looks like as officers are leaving the scene, just having some protesters or bystanders, agitators, throwing some snowballs at them as they leave. We saw this earlier.
We did. Yep, we saw this exact thing earlier, and this is targeted toward ICE agents at that particular time. But now, as you mentioned, this is MPD, BCA was on scene, the sheriff's department as well.
So for our international viewers who don't remember, the BLM George Floyd riots began in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is exactly where this is. So a place of a lot of tension, ethnic tension, strife, especially with law enforcement in the community. The mayor came on. He's milquetoast, but he said, "Get the fuck out of our city," et cetera, et cetera. Things are not looking good. I don't know, man. I feel like something broke this weekend. I implore you all to read Arnold's piece about the death of the United States moral grounding. And it's very scary. And speaking of moral grounding, we'll bring a little bit of levity.
They say you have seized Venezuela for the oil. Yes, this is true, that there is that which has been brought to the forefront of this earthly battle. But the enemy has sought and was seeking to bring war and to bring conflict through Venezuela and to control the oil of the earth. But the spiritual oil and the natural oil does not belong to the forces of darkness or to those who thought that they could bring a one world order. This is my reset. And the oil of the natural and the oil of the spirit is mine, says the Lord.
You feel safe?
Wow. The oil of the Lord. I think he got oils mixed up because this is petroleum and he might be thinking about the oil to consecrate like kings like they did in like the biblical times, or like, you know, to anoint a body when you're dying or
no,
dead.
This is prosperity gospel, Chris. They mean oil.
They mean black good. They mean the black stuff. They mean
black
that
gold.
You know, it's sick. That stuff is sick. These people are sick. But that's, you know.
Well,
at this point, I just want to say we have helped to bring the truth to you all. But when you start to see American soldiers, men, women, I don't care who they are, coming home in body bags, don't say we didn't warn you. Don't say we didn't warn you. Don't say we didn't tell the truth. Don't say we didn't show you how this is going to unfold. But they want to do it. All right. Game on, I guess, for them. They're gonna have their time to shine. And we'll see. But I think that the United States is in for a rough time.
I think so, too. I think the internal strife is going to get out of control. And it might even be this weekend. But before that, I want all of you guys, even if you're not Orthodox, to try to have a Merry Christmas. It is also the day of the Epiphany, I believe. And
that's
so
nice.
It's a very important day for all of us sort of kind of bask in the light of Jesus, I guess, if you allow me to be a little bit corny, but I think today we need it more than ever, given what's going on in the United States and around the world. I really want to thank you all for joining us today. And I'm really stoked that we got to get Glenn on finally. More good news, more guests on Monday. We will have a special stream with Scott Horton for you guys, working on getting you guys more guests more frequently, at least once a week. So, you know, we can incorporate some stuff in it into the show. Other than that, we will see you guys on Sunday for our regular stream. And I'm going to leave you with this really beautiful video.
Whoa, from Super Chats.
Super Chats. Oh, thank you. What an effed up start to the new year. It is Wednesday. Like we don't even get like a week off. The second week of the year. I always start the intro compliments. Thank you, Stoshik.
Thank you, bro. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. And as always, thank you for watching, Nathan. And we will be the greatest show on YouTube one day. Other than that, again, Monday, Scott Horton, Sunday, regular stream. Please enjoy this video from Ethiopia. This is last year, but this year is just as beautiful. So Merry Christmas to you all. We will see you on Monday. Sunday. Both. We'll see you on both.
Sunday.